about to start our last program here at the Holocaust Museum and Study Center. My name is Tanya Saret. I'm the executive director, and it's wonderful to see this beautiful turnout over the course of this afternoon's program. We had a film at 12:30, and Ella Moskin was speaking at 1:30. That's our third component of the program, and thanks for joining us. The ones who like to be a little bit closer up here are welcome to move up a little bit. Those who feel comfortable where they are, please stay. There are a few seats available here in the front if you'd like to get a little closer to the PowerPoint presentation. It's our pleasure this afternoon to introduce or to welcome a speaker that is a little special shidduch that happened here with the museum, and I have to really thank Rabbi Shalom Friedman from Torah Mizora, who connected us here at the Holocaust Museum with Rabbi Yaakov Astor. Rabbi Yaakov Astor wrote a wonderful book called The Hidden Hand, and there are two editions. One is particularly on the Holocaust, and you will hear over the next hour very interesting, intriguing, in quotation marks, coincidences or God's hand over the course of history, particularly the First World War and the Second World War, the Holocaust. They kind of shaped history and shaped us as a Jewish people. It's a page-turner that I only can recommend any of you to purchase. It's a book that you hardly can put down. And it makes you want and think a lot about why things happen over the course of time, even so there are much more questions and hardly really any answers, but it gives you a different perspective that can be only helpful or enriching. One thing, and I spoke about it, was Rabbi Astor. Today is July 20th, and when you talk about coincidences or why certain dates matter, today is Tisha B'Av in the Jewish calendar, and it's obviously a very meaningful and day for us as a Jewish people. But when I look into the regular calendar, it's July 20th. And for me, when I think about July 20th, it always has a very significant, it's a significant date for me, because on July 20th, a group of German military officials, high-ranking military officials, tried to assassinate Adolf Hitler on July 20th. They didn't succeed, obviously. They were caught, and many of them were killed and executed that particular night already. And Rabbi Astor speaks about that group also in his book, The Hidden Hand. So today is Tisha B'Av and July 20th, so a time to commemorate not only that our people went through tremendous suffering over the years, and the second and the first temple were destroyed centuries ago, but Tisha B'Av really reminds us that we as a people went through a lot over the course of history, and it's not only a day to reconnect with us as a people, but also to remember that we can be only get stronger as a people of staying together and being connected to each other, and master these challenges that kind of came along over the course of history. I would like to give Ron Friedman an opportunity to speak for a few moments. Like I said, he made the shidduch between us, the Holocaust Museum, and Rabbi Astor, and I'm very grateful that he helped us find such a wonderful and very appropriate speaker for this afternoon's program. So thanks again, Rabbi Friedman, for being here and for making the shidduch, and please come up for a moment.
Thank you, Mrs. Saret, for giving me the opportunity just for a brief moment to introduce Rabbi Astor. My name is Rabbi Shalom Friedman. I am the director of Zechor Yemais Olam, which is the Holocaust Education in Torah Mesera. And we developed a relationship with the center, and in particular Mrs. Saret. And I look forward to being able to have other opportunities to work together in the future. Just the mere fact that we're here today on Tisha B'Av is a tremendous statement on behalf of Klal Yisrael, that we can, from thousands of years ago, still commemorate an event goes to show how much we consider precious our heritage and the fact that we're prepared to do something about it and work together and hopefully make some type of changes for the better in the future. There's no question that the lessons of the Holocaust are ever so relevant today. When I lived in Europe for many years before I moved back to America, thinking that moving to America I wouldn't have to experience the type of anti-Semitism that we were experiencing in Europe. But unfortunately, I think we're beginning to see signs of a change of within our own communities, and we're experiencing anti-Semitism ourselves here. And it's ever so more relevant for us to recognize and to learn the lessons of the Holocaust and amidst Hashem to be able to make some type of change. With no further ado, I would like to introduce my very good friend, Rav Yaakov Aster, who is working together with us and other projects, and I have no doubt that the time you spend listening to him will be very rewarding. Shkaya.
Thank you. Thank you, Mrs. Sarrett and Rabbi Friedman. If there's a problem, if you have any issues seeing something or hearing something anywhere, please raise your hand. It's an honor to be here. It's an honor to be here in general. It's an honor especially to be here on Tisha B'Av, one of the most powerful days in the Jewish calendar. I'm going to try and jump right into it. I'm going to have to step forward and press my button every once in a while, so bear with me. Context. Things in the Jewish perspective don't just happen, or in any perspective. Depends how you see it. What is the context? These two verses are verses that we, the Jewish people, it's in the Siddur, in the prayer book, four times a day we say these two verses together. Four times a day. Three times in the morning, once in the afternoon. It's more so than any other pair of, or any of the single verse. Even perhaps more than the Shema, which is the verse that was supposed to say a baby when he's first born. The first, when the child can first speak, the first thing he's supposed to teach him, if you can, is the Shema. And the last thing a person is supposed to say before they die is the verse of the Shema Israel, Hear, O Israel, Lord is our God, God, Lord is one. But we say these even more each day than that. First one is from Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah. Holy, holy, holy is God of the heavens. The whole world is filled with his glory. Second one is in the prophet Ezekiel. Blessed is the glory of God from his throne. And I'm going to... There's a Rabbi Reisman who explains these words in a really fascinating way. And he explains them that not only are these words just words that we say, these are actually words that are said every day, all the time, by angels. Angels in the Jewish perspective are very high, intelligent, they have great intelligence, and they have a great perspective that that humans can't have, even though humans have the potential to be greater because we have free will, we can choose right or wrong, they can't. But the angels understand they're higher intelligence. And Rabbi Reisman explains that there's two sets of angels, and all the time they're arguing each other. It's literally a fiery debate. The first set of angels are called the Sarfei HaKodesh, they're called literally the holy fiery angels. And they say, holy, holy, holy is God of the heavens. The whole world is filled with his glory. And the way Rabbi Reisman explains it, the whole world is filled with his glory. Everywhere you go, you can see God. You see God in a beautiful tulip, in a young baby. You see God in coincidences in life. You meet your spouse. You meet your business partner. In a sporting event, the guy makes a ridiculous catch or something like that. All these, I don't want to belittle it that way, but anything that you see that's beautiful coincidence in your life, that's good, that's happy, that brings happiness, the whole world is filled with the glory. You feel this tremendous, we can see God everywhere. God is, in philosophical terms, there's a word that's called immanent. God is immanent. He's right here. That's what these first set of angels are saying. We feel God, we see God, he's all over the place. Then Rabbi Reisman explains, but then these other angels, they're called the Ofanim and the Chayos HaKodesh, these other set of angels, they get up there and they say, what do you mean the whole world is filled with his glory? Blessed is the glory of God, we bless him, but he's from his place. He's remote, he's in his place. How can you say, even you, the smartest angels with tremendous intelligence, how can you say you know what God is and where God is? And that everything is God. God is above even the highest, most intelligent being that you can imagine. And there's nothing we can imagine. We can only recognize that he exists, but we really can't know. Bless his glory from his place. We don't know what that place is, but from his place, we bless him. and these angels go back and forth. The first set say their verse, and the second set say theirs, and they go up higher, and there it's a whole argument going back and forth. When you think about it, this is really the root of what's at the human condition. And within ourselves or within other people, sometimes externally, but certainly even within ourselves, if you're a thinking person, I believe, sometimes you feel that the whole world is filled with this glory. You see the beauty of life and the beauty and wonderful things happen, and it's so obvious that there's something, a presence, and there's an imminence. But then there's the eminence. God is not imminent, he emanates. He emanates from a place where we don't feel it. He feels distant. God is distant. A tragedy happens. You wanted something good to happen. It didn't happen. Where is God? The Holocaust happens. It happens on an individual level or on a national level. These are the questions that come from the perspective of the angels. Where is the God from? Blessed is the glory of God from his place. Notice that the angels, they bless him. They recognize God. They don't doubt that God exists. But they don't know his place. They can't pinpoint it. They can't hold it. How could this tragedy happen? How could this terrible thing happen? And if you learn Talmud, if you learn the Tanakh and the Bible and all that, you'll see that there's plenty of tragedies, and yet we believe in God, and yet we have people that are recognized as people that believe in God. Because even when he's from his place, even when he's eminent, not imminent from our perspective, we bless him, we recognize him. These are the two ideas that I wanted to introduce and give context to. Because what The Hidden Hand is, my book, The Hidden Hand, as the name presents itself, is that it's trying to identify elements. It's trying to identify elements in history that where maybe we can discern a hidden hand of God. Now you should know that there's two levels. There's the level of the individual, and then there's the level on the national level, and then the micro level and the macro level, And there are many people, I think, if you talk to people, many people can identify with the idea that there's something that happens in an individual level that really doesn't make sense. It seems like coincidence. In fact, Carl Jung, the disciple of Freud, came up with a term called synchronicity. To synchronize, two things that don't make any sense, all of a sudden they coincide, they synchronize. And even in the secular world of Jungian psychology, there's something called synchronicity. People understand that. When I was working and teaching for a while, and I asked myself, if there's such a thing as synchronicity on the individual level, we should also be able to see it on the macro level, on the national level. And that's when I started beginning to think about the book of The Hidden Hand many years ago. It took many years to write it. The first one came out in 07, and this one on the Holocaust just came out last year. But the idea was to find something on a not just individual levels, but on a larger level that might give a rational person. We're not talking about just believing for the sake of believing, which is its own value. But for a person, we're rational beings. Can we have a rational basis for believing in such a thing as divine providence, for believing in such a thing as synchronicity? That was the idea of the Hidden Hand books. And grew into two books, and we're working, maybe down the line we'll even have more. But for right now, the first one dealt with divine providence in major events of the 20th century, and this one dealt on a much more difficult level to deal with. Could there be, is it maybe even some people would say, if you're from these angels, if this is who you identify with, you might say, it's sacrilegious to even suggest there's a hidden hand in the Holocaust. That's a question, people, it's a natural question. I have it myself. I myself have this question. How could you say that? But the truth is that I have one advantage, probably over most of you, that none of you have. I have a mother-in-law. And I've been able to observe my mother-in-law for 25 years. My mother-in-law is a Holocaust survivor. And I'm going to briefly just tell you about her story to understand that why I feel, have a little more confidence to say that there can be such a thing, even in the horrors of the Holocaust, that it can be such a thing that a person can come out of it and say, you know what, blessed is the glory of Hashem from his place. Even though he's from his place, I don't feel it, I understand the terror, but I bless God and I recognize God. And my mother-in-law, just to briefly discuss her background, and she comes up, you know, since she retired a few years ago, she comes to the house every day, I see her virtually every day. She grew up in a town called Ludmir. Today it's called Vladimir. This is the Ukraine, This is the city Kiev. If you remember, Kiev is the place of the famous, the infamous Holocaust event. Anyone know what that is?
Babi Yar.
So Babi Yar was, in 2 days, 33,000 Jews were machine gunned to death. My mother-in-law grew up not far from there. I think it was about 50 miles in that direction. Now, by the way, Ludmir, that's the name Ludmir, they called it Vladimir, was, in, when she was born, not called Ludmir, it was called, I had the devil of a time trying to figure out how to pronounce that. She had to spend like a half hour with me trying until I finally got it. I think I got it now. Lodzimnysh. Lodzimnysh is the same place as Vladimir, same place as Ludmir. Why is it called Lodzimnysh? Because after World War I, the Allies created a new state called Poland. It actually recreated Poland. And now this part, which had been part of the Ukraine, now became part of Poland. And Poland called this country, this land, this city that used to be Vladimir or Ludmir, they called it Lodzimnysh, but the name Ludmir stayed. Anyway, back and forth. She grew up here, and she's not sure of her birth date, that's another story. But basically, what happened was, is that in 1939, before 1939, she grew up in Poland, she learned Polish. In 1939, the Germans attacked Poland, and in less than a month defeated Poland. Because of a secret pact with the Russians, half of Poland, more than half, went to Germany, and the other half went to the USSR, to Russia. So my mother-in-law, all of a sudden now, lives, instead of living under Polish dominion, she's living under Russian dominion. And then, in 1941, on June 22nd, 1941, another famous date in World War II history, anyone know what that's particularly called? He wanted to do that for sure. He always wanted to do that. But on June 22nd, 1940, right, it was called Operation Barbarossa. Hitler decided, not so great. Anyway, Hitler decided, you can't see it so much, but he went, he had a secret treaty, he had a secret peace treaty with Stalin and Hitler, and then Hitler stabbed him in the back and broke the treaty and attacked. And when he attacked, he started conquering vast areas of Russia. My mother-in-law's house in Ludmir, you see, here's Kiev. The line, you can't really see it, but the line was right around here. Kiev's over here. My mother-in-law was 20 miles inside the border. They got hit the first day, the day that that the Germans started bombing the inside Russian lines, her city and town was bombed. And the Germans came in just a few hours later, and they're already in her town. I could spend the whole time telling you her story. I wish I could. I'm just going to cut to the chase to tell you a little bit about her. One, it was the classic German takeover. They came in, they set up a Judenrat, which was Jews that were supposed to give the Jewish community a feeling of security that they're running it, but really the Germans told the Judenrat what to do. And the Judenrat was really just ultimately to help the Germans set up the exportation to extermination camps much faster. But in any event, the Judenrat was set up, and then they were made into a ghetto. My mother-in-law was 9 years old at the time, just 10 years old at the time. Maybe she was 12 at that time, actually. She was one of those little kids that used to smuggle out under the gate sometime and bring back food. They didn't have a wall like in the Warsaw ghetto, but they had barbed wire, and she was able to do that. In any event, she kept her family alive. To make a long story short, in 1942, September 1942, in Holocaust, one of the things the Germans would do is that they would round up the Jews in a town that they had already put in ghetto, and they'd take them out to be machine gunned to death. My mother-in-law had gotten, and as far, her father, she, her mother had died before the war, but her father and her four siblings had gotten word that this was going to happen, and beforehand they built a false ceiling in their house. They'd taken the... The father was good at construction. He put lumber in the ceiling, and he actually took some fire, some leaves, and they made a smoke, and he made the lumber look like it was old. And when the time came, it was, I think, September 1st, 1942, if I recall correctly, a few hours before the Nazis and the Ukrainians came in to liquidate the ghetto, they went up to this attic. And she hid in this attic, she says, for 2 weeks, without food, without water. She says, the way you went in, the way you went out. You know, we're holding about 14 hours with no food and no water. You know, for some people, it's a tremendous sacrifice and difficulty to be without a cell phone. But we're without water and it's difficult. And my mother-in-law did it for, she says, 2 weeks. I asked the doctor. The doctor says it's really not possible, but she's there. And I went back and checked some records. It was about 2 weeks that this liquidation went on. In 2 weeks, the Nazis killed, machine gunned 15,000 of the 22,000 people of Lumiere. But my mother-in-law and her family were alive. To make a long story short, again, they survived the winter. They were still hiding out. One by one, each of her family members died. Her brothers, one froze to death while they were hiding in the attic. Imagine, you can't move him. He was froze to death, and they're up in the attic, and his body is beginning to smell. We can't even imagine. Even if we usually tell it, we can't really imagine. Then another brother a couple of other brothers were killed trying to get food, and then the father. In December 1943, they came to liquidate the last few thousand Jews left in Budmir. And my mother-in-law managed to escape into another hiding place again. And she hid it's a miraculous story. I really could spend so much time on it. I see it's hard to just constrict it. Maybe another time we could discuss that. But in any event, she came out of there. She found a hiding place. She got out of the hiding place and went with a friend to a Polish woman who had been a neighbor of theirs. And the Polish woman took them in and kept them for a month. And then she was afraid she was discovered. She had to run away again. And she now was all on her own. Imagine she's 14 years old, you're all alone, no family, and you're a Jew. And in Ukraine, Nazi-occupied Ukraine. And Ukrainians, if you know a little bit about it, were the Latvians and Lithuanians were amongst the worst collaborators that the Nazis had in killing Jews. So she was really, I have to say the odds are astronomical that such a person, a kid, could survive. She walked into a barn one day, one morning, and it was freezing cold. Her feet were soaked, and she decided to put her feet in the straw just to hope to live another day. All of a sudden, the door to the barn opened up, and a lady walked in. The lady saw her, and she saw the lady. And my mother-in-law said, she's 14, she says, "I'm a Jew. I promise I won't stay more than another day. Just let me stay for one more day. And I won't bother anyone, and you won't get in trouble." You know, a lot there were of those non-Jews that helped, that lived amongst the Jews. Many were terrible and really horrible people. Some were real righteous people and are recognized, even though they weren't recognized by Yad Vashem. And many were in between. They could have done good, they could have done bad, but things swayed in one way or another. So a lot of them knew that if they held Jews and got caught, that they'd be taken by the Nazis and killed themselves. In any event, this woman decided she wasn't going to do anything. And she said, that night, in fact, she came back to the barn before my mother-in-law left. She said, "Come into the house." And she invited her into the house. It was the freezing cold Russian-Ukrainian winter. I can't imagine what it was. There was snow on the ground. She was freezing. They brought her into the house, and they gave her some food. She didn't know it at the time, but this couple, Mrs. Rulak and Mr. Rulak, had a son, like a 17-year-old son, who, believe it or not, worked in the local SS office. It turns out that he's not as bad as you might think either. But in the end, they said like this, "We would love to keep you." We want to talk about coincidence in the hand. It turns out that this woman said, "Who are you?" And she said, "My name is Rachel Bloom." And she said, "Rachel Bloom, was your father Mr. Gershon Bloom?" She said, "Yes. I did business dealings with your father. Your father was an honest man. In fact, there were times when he'd let us get some of his goods and without having to pay for them. And he was an honest man." And then the father piped up, and the father said, "Listen, we know who your father was, we know who you are, but the truth is we can't keep you. Because if the Germans find us, they'll kill us and our whole family. You can stay here the night, but in the morning you've got to be gone." So my mother-in-law, 14 years old, can you imagine? She looks at them, and she says, "Do you have a Bible? Your Bible?" She said, "Yes." She said, "I want you to bring it out." So they brought it out. They put it down on the table. She said, "I want each of you to put your hand on the Bible. You, Mr. Rulak, Mrs. Rulak, and the son, put your hand on the Bible. I want you to swear on your Bible that after we finish this meal, I'm going to go outside to the back of the house, and I'm going to lie down in the snow, and I'm going to freeze to death. And you're going to bury me. But I want you to swear on your Bible that after the war, you find Jewish people that are going to survive this war, you find them, you tell them, buried here as a little Jewish girl, her last wish was that you bury her in a Jewish cemetery. So, she's just an amazing lady. So, in any event, the lady looked at her, the husband looked at her and said, this little girl, we can't let her go. And they decided to keep her. And they kept her till the end of the war, and that's how she survived the war, and that's how she's alive today. Yeah. That's my mother-in-law. Now, that's only half the story. If you knew my mother-in-law is the most energetic, upbeat, positive person, and I've heard her say personally several times, nothing bad ever happened to me. I don't get it. But that's what I've heard her say. And she doesn't just say it, she lives it. She's in this home in Suffern. She's so active that Governor Pataki gave her an award for being a community leader or something like this. She does everything, and she's an unbelievable person. And so I go back to that first verse, and I say, the whole world is filled with Hashem's glory. That's easy to say when there's a bris, when there's a newborn, when there's a wedding, when there's a wonderful event in life. But how do you say, blessed is God from his place, when things are so bad, when there's a Holocaust, when there's a horrible tragedy? I don't know the answer to that question so easily. It's not so simple. But I look at my mother-in-law, and that's what she does. That's what she did. That's what she represents. She represents that type of person. That gave me the confidence to come here today and to write a book like the Hidden Hand, to say that we can, and we shouldn't be afraid to say, that there is such a thing as divine providence, as a hidden hand, even in tragedy. It doesn't mean that we can see it. Again, there's two sets of angels that are having this argument. Some say we can see it, we can see the good. Sometimes, though, there are no answers, at least no answers that come to our mind, that come to the finite human mind. But nevertheless, we bless Hashem, the glory of God, even from his place. That's a Jewish response, the very Jewish response, to say, I don't have an answer, but I still recognize that God exists. And I think that's my mother-in-law. I don't think she has answers. You can't philosophically, she can't explain them, and I can't have that conversation with her. But she knows that there's a God, even though she went through that, and she didn't let that stop her in her life. She is a tremendous inspiration. She should be to everybody. But she's not the only one of her type. There's so many Holocaust survivors that did not let the tragedy of the Holocaust or any type of tragedy get in their way of becoming very productive people like that. And it's a tremendous inspiration. So the Hidden Hand. This is sort of off the board, a little bit different, but as you see, President Obama said this beginning of his presidency, and when he was in Buchenwald. As we reflect today on the human capacity for evil, our shared obligation to defy it, we're also reminded of the human capacity for good. For amidst the countless acts of cruelty that took place here, we know that there were many acts of courage and kindness as well. The Jews who insisted on fasting on Yom Kippur, the camp cook who hid potatoes in the lining of his prison uniform and distributed them to his fellow inmates, risking his own life to save theirs, the prisoners who organized a special effort to protect the children here in Buchenwald, sheltering them from work and giving them extra food. I think this is the idea that there is a hidden hand. These people did not let, these are the people that they bless Hashem, bless God from his place. They did not let the tragedy take away their faith, some did, but many did not, and they certainly did not let their tragedy take away their humanity and their dignity. And that's an important lesson to understand, that if we came away with nothing else, we didn't even start at the Hidden Hand, but that the idea is that even amidst tragedy, and that's what Tisha B'Av is about, even amidst tragedy, we bless God because we understand that he's the source of our faith and the source of our human dignity, of our ability to be human beings and live in a dignified way. Now, that was an introduction, actually. Now we'll get into the Hidden Hand. One of the reasons I wrote the Hidden Hand, there are history books out there. If people ask me if this is a history book, I didn't want to write a history book. Because one of my favorite rabbis, Rabbi Grauer Wine, said it beautifully, facts are boring. Indeed, most history courses in school are lethal. I remember hating history and falling asleep in classes. This book has history, but I think it's the idea of a story and it's putting in the context of things that there is a God and there are connections. Hopefully it's more than just a history book. I'm going to try to go through this quickly. We know today is Tisha B'Av. We know that there are many tragedies that happen on Tisha B'Av. Here are five things that is brought in one of the books of the Talmud about what happened on Tisha B'Av. The children of Israel were told they would not live to enter the land of Israel. That was the first Tisha B'Av back in the desert in the year 2449 or the 48, one of those 2 years. Next, the first temple was destroyed. Solomon's temple was destroyed on the 9th of Av. Tisha B'Av is the 9th of Av, the ninth day of the month of Av. The people, they said they're not, you're going to wander in the desert 40 years. The next one, the temple was destroyed. Remarkably, 410 years later, the second temple was destroyed, also on Tisha B'Av. Next, 60 years after the second temple was destroyed, no one thought, but the Jewish people mounted another rebellion against the great Roman Empire. In fact, no one fought the Romans like the Jews. The Romans lost more people to the Jews than any other people. 60 years after, there was a great person named Shimon Bar Kochva. He was a person that Rabbi Akiva, the greatest Jewish sage of the time, said could have, should have been, and if things had been right, would have been the Messiah. Unfortunately, things happened, and it was the whole story by itself. He retreated to the city of Beitar, and when the Romans finally defeated him in Beitar, more than a million people were also killed. These are a million people were killed also in the Second Temple, the city of Beitar. This was before the time of modern technology with gas chambers and trucks and all these things. The third thing that happened on Tisha B'Av that's brought in the Talmudic sources is that the Temple Mount was plowed. Today's Temple Mount is apparently, Rabbi Wein says, it's apparently about 1,000 feet lower than it was in the time of the Romans. That today, if you go in the Temple Mount, it looks up to the mount, different mountains around them. But the Roman Emperor Hadrian, who was the Hitler of his day, was so upset at Bar Kokhba and those that he said, we're going to plow the temple, and he used the slaves to reduce the temple 1,000 feet. It's much smaller and lower than it was. All these tragedies happened on Tisha B'Av, and that the Talmud brings down. National tragedy. But what happened, what's interesting, is that these things continued after. Tisha B'Av did not just happen in those five things. In July 18, 1290, on Tisha B'Av, in the year 1290, Edward I issued an edict of expulsion for the Jews from England. So Tisha B'Av in the year 1290 also was a day of tragedy, national tragedy. The Jews of England were told that they had to go. It didn't stop then. In Tisha B'Av in 1492, the Jews were expelled from Spain. You know about that, you know about that situation. Does 1492 sound familiar to anybody? Columbus, that what I heard? Columbus himself writes in his log, and people don't know this, that he had great difficulty leading his three little ships out of the port because there was such a backlog of other ships, and the Jews were on that day in Tisha B'Av, they had to leave. And the days leading up to it, when Columbus was leaving, he had to get out with them, and it was just a tremendous traffic jam in the port. And he writes that he couldn't get out. All these things are leading to a point. It's not just that these things are coincidences. We have to ask ourselves, thinking people have to ask themselves, if these things are all happening on the same day, is it coincidence? Well, let's look about what happened in 1492 a little bit more. Again, this is Rabbi Wein. I'm going to read it to you. On August 2nd, 1492, Spain became a graveyard of Jewish hopes and lives. The Talmud teaches, however, that God provides the cure before giving the illness. Very interesting idea. God provides the cure before giving the illness. And that black day had a ray of light in it, a ray of light worn on three small ships, who many feared would fall over the edge of the world. On August 3, 1492, Columbus set out on a historic voyage. He, in fact, writes in his log how he was delayed in the harbor by the traffic of ships evacuating Jews. The journey of Christopher Columbus across the frightening Atlantic must be reckoned as one of the turning points in the history of civilization. America, and all that it would later come to represent, would master Europe, inexorably change it, and itself usurped the dominant role in the story of man. But all of this was not yet visible even to the most far-seeing savants of Europe in 1492. Only later would the irony of the divine plan be seen. On that very day when Spain chose to close this out 6 centuries of intense and productive Jewish life on its soil, Columbus sailed to discover a new continent where there would be a safe haven for Jews and others, and where the people of Israel would once again be able to rise to a preeminent role in general society. That black day in August 1492 had a ray of brightness to it. Pity that this did not become apparent for another 4 centuries. Rabbi Wein still telling us the idea of a hidden hand. that the Tisha B'Av is not just a coincidence, that when so many coincidences happen in such a way, and then compounded by the fact of Columbus leaving at that time, setting up the future, the cure before the illness, we have to ask ourselves, a thinking person has to ask themselves, a rational person, how can I say there is not a divine hand? Or can I? It's much harder to say that. The hidden hand. And one more here. Yeah. King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella decreed a deadline beyond which all Jews remaining in Spain must either convert or die at the stake. A day that fell on the 9th of the Hebrew month of Av, the anniversary of the destruction of both temples in Jerusalem. To the tens of thousands of Jews crossing the border to lives of suffering and uncertainty, the date was a divine omen, signifying that though God was angry with them, he had not forgotten them. Blessed be God from his, the glory of God from his place. We don't necessarily, we don't have answers. We don't know why things happen. It's a tragedy. But we bless God. We understand that there's a hidden hand there. That's a very Jewish concept. That's the key Jewish concept that the book of Hidden Hand is about. Anyway, the tragedies of Tisha B'Av didn't stop with Columbus. World War I began on Tisha B'Av. Now, anybody that knows history knows that World War I was really almost, the way World War I ended, almost had to be World War II. The Versailles Treaty made it impossible. And many, many people, some people have written that World War I and really II were really just one war with an intervening number of years stopping it. But in fact, if that's so, World War II and the Holocaust began on Tisha B'Av. But if that's not enough for you, and this is what I go into in the Hidden Hand, I have a chapter in here on the Hidden Hand, which goes into more detail about this last one. The final solution reached its peak. First Jews of Warsaw Ghetto were guests at Treblinka. Now, the Warsaw Ghetto wasn't just any ghetto. At various times, it got as many as 450,000 people were in the Warsaw Ghetto, in a place that could normally hold 150,000 people. These 450,000 people represented, was by far and away the largest concentration of Jews in Europe. The next largest city, I believe, was Lodz. Lodz has 120,000. It was a good three-fourths size times the size. Warsaw, in other words, was, if there had to be one place that represented what Jewry was in Europe, it was Warsaw. You know a lot, I'm going to go through a little bit of the history of Warsaw, but we're going to see that the key date of the gassing of the Jews in Treblinka and the concentration camp made specifically for the Jews of Warsaw happened on Tisha B'Av. That's a lesser known fact. Let's talk about the Warsaw Ghetto quickly. The video didn't come out good. But anyway, 450,000 Jews in a 3.5 square mile area, which normally housed about 160,000. Let me go through this quickly. One of the things in the Hidden Hand that I tried to show is that in the book of the Bible, there's a whole chapter called the Reproof, and chapter 28 of the book of Deuteronomy. And in there's a lot of things that people say, precursors that foretell the Holocaust. I'm just going to go briefly through some of the verses. More of them are in my book, The Hidden Hand. This one, God will bring upon you a nation from afar, from the end of the earth, it will sweep down like an eagle, which is very telling. You know, the symbol, one of the main symbols of the Nazi was the Nazi eagle. The other thing is that the Nazis introduced a new type of warfare. The reason they were so successful at the beginning is they introduced a new warfare called Blitzkrieg. Blitzkrieg means fast war, lightning war. They did it in two ways. They had tanks on the ground that were used in an offensive way that had never been used before in World War I. And they also used planes, unlike any other war, as almost like artillery shooting down on the advanced troops. It was a very light, and between the tanks and the planes, it was a lightning-fast war. And one of the most famous Nazi war planes of that period that took part in this Blitzkrieg was the Stuka dive bomb. And here you see the Stuka would go down, would release its bomb, and then it would fly off. The bombs would have an extra whistle on it. It would sound like a screeching bird coming down from the sky. So you see some things, the idea of the Bible saying that a nation of parts would screech, come down upon you like an eagle. But anyway, the key dates in the Warsaw Ghetto, September 1, the Nazis invaded Germany. I don't have time to talk about Heydrich, who was the head of the Jewish, responsible for the liquidation of, and the Jewish solution to the Jewish problem. He did something called the Schnell Brief, which is a memo already written in September 21st, 1939, that outlines what came to be known as the final solution. He called it the final aim. But if people want to identify the beginning of the of documented evidence that the Nazis intended to liquidate all the Jews, many people point to Heydrich's Schnell Brief. That was September 21, 1939. The Nazis hadn't even conquered all of Poland yet, although they were about to. Because a week later, in September 28th, they captured Warsaw. There's the two we just went through. Continuing, On November 23, 1939, just less than a month later, the Nazis proclaimed that Jews must wear a white badge with the Star of David on the right arm. People often make the mistake and think it was a yellow badge. Wasn't until later. But the first place, some people say it was discovered, the idea of a badge of a Jewish star took place on Kristallnacht. And we find some documented evidence that some of the Nazis were talking about on Kristallnacht. But it never became anything until November 23, 1939 was the first time in Warsaw that Jews were told to wear something a star identifying them as Jews. October 12, 1940, on Yom Kippur, the Nazis did this intentionally, the Nazis announced the establishment of the ghetto in Warsaw and all Jews must move in. Jews had to move into that, 450,000 Jews had to move into that small area meant for 150,000. And November 16, 1940, the wall was finished, the ghetto was sealed. I have some pictures depicting this. And if you can see this, here's the wall in the construction in October 1940. It wasn't quite yet done. And over here, we have, by November 16th, the wall is done. The Jews are sealed in. 450,000 people are sealed in the Warsaw ghetto. Later on, the Nazis split the ghetto into two, a small ghetto and a large ghetto, and they had a bridge over seeing it. And finally, the final solution is being implemented in stages. Again, in the book, I talk about some of the stages, but basically, now the Jews are in ghettos. Now the next thing is to conscript them into labor. But this is already predicted in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 28. Your sons and your daughters shall be given unto another nation. You will see it happening with your own eyes and will long for them all day long, but you will be powerless and you shall serve your enemy. So that we know that the Jewish labor, forced labor, was all over the place. There's a picture of some Jews being conscripted into forced labor. By the way, just to remind you of a story, my mother-in-law remembers a story in September 1941 where she saw some people going off to Kiev. The Nazis had taken some Jews to go to Kiev, supposedly to build railroads. And she knows in retrospect now that they were probably sent to help build the graves of Babi Yar, so that eventually the Jews were shot into. So Jews were conscripted into all kinds of horrible slave labor. And you shall serve your enemy in famine and thirst. You will be set with illness and plagues, not even mentioned in the Torah. You know, these are famous pictures of children starving to death, horrible, horrible things in the Warsaw Ghetto. You don't have to elaborate this, you're probably well very aware of it. Another verse in the Torah says, the stranger that is in your midst shall mount up above you higher and higher. I mean, of all the terrible indignities that you have to deal with, after all this, who's put in charge of you? Strangers. So there's a book called The Warsaw Ghetto. This is documented in other places, but in the Warsaw Ghetto Diaries, he was there. He writes, appointed to head the police in says in Warsaw was the apostate Sierzynski, previously a colonel in the Polish police. Many leading positions were held by either assimilationists, mostly lawyers, or baptized Jews like Sierzynski. So you have all these terrible predictions in the Torah coming literally true in the Holocaust. One last one before we move forward. Again, the verse says, there will come a time when you'll be willing to sell yourselves as slaves to your enemies to do any sort of menial task, and there will be no buyer. Rashi, the primary commentator on the Jewish commentator, says, you will offer yourselves to be sold as slaves. You'll do anything, but there will be no buyer, even though they need you, because the decree is that you shall be killed. So in other words, there'll come a time, even after all this, you'll wish you'll have the cards, the white cards, that will, or the working cards that tell you that you can now become a slave laborer to Nazis. You'll wish for that, but you won't even be able to get that. And we know this is why, because it'd be set for to be killed for extermination. They didn't want to capture Jews at this point. They didn't want to capture you to be part of the slave labor unit. They wanted to capture you to kill you. All these things literally became true. I'm leaving this up to you because I want to get to the point of Tisha B'Av. All these horrible things were happening in the Warsaw Ghetto, the representation of all Jewry. And while this was happening, when did this happen? Even as terrible as things were, the Jews still lived in families. Many were sent off. People were sent, sons and daughters were sent off to slave labor, and people were dying. It was horrible. 100,000 people died in the ghetto because of disease and starvation. It was horrible. But it was not yet deportation to death camps. When we talk about the phases and the stages of the Holocaust, and there are such things, death in ghettos is a stage. But then there's something called death in concentration camps, in death camps. And the German genius for factories was now put into not just making cars or airplanes, but to killing people. That was a new thing in history. The industrial age used specifically to kill people en masse in an assembly-like style. That's what most historians refer to when they say the final solution. That's what they mean. The final solution is when people were sent off specifically to be killed, not just in ghettos, but onto death camps. When did that happen? On July 22, 1942, Jews were deported to Treblinka. Treblinka was, there were several death camps. There was four or five major death camps. Treblinka was one of them. Treblinka was specific for the Jews of Warsaw. It happened on July 22, 1942. It took them a day to travel in those sealed trains to Treblinka. When did that happen? July 23, 1942. That was Tisha B'Av. So we're in 2010. So that's that's 68 years ago. 68 years ago today, the first Jews were gassed in Treblinka, and as part of what I'm trying to suggest was the real final solution. Because Warsaw was the representation of all Jewry, and the final solution was the deportation of death camps. That was Tisha B'Av, 1942. Between the next couple of months, until September 1941, almost 300,000 Jews will be gassed in Treblinka. This is the final solution. This is my date. I put, as I discuss in the book, believing the real final solution, even though other things were horrible and leading up to it. July 23, 1942. Now, we're going to find another thing in the hidden hand that I discuss. I'm going to talk about it briefly, then quickly to the point. One of the turning points in the war was the Battle of Stalingrad. Stalingrad was a major. Anyway. I'll be short to the point. Stalingrad, according to historians, there's two major turning points in the war. One was Stalingrad, one was El Alamein. Some people say it was Stalingrad, some say people it was El Alamein. Most historians will say it was either one or the other. And more probably will say Stalingrad than El Alamein. Stalingrad was the Russian city that was named after their dictator Stalin, their leader Stalin. And at first in 1942, the Germans had started a new offensive and were about to head towards Stalingrad, and just like I'd done in the previous summer, they were really defeating the Russians. It looked like there was no stopping them, and they came to the, you can't see it, this is Stalingrad, they came to the edge of Stalingrad on, guess what date, on Tisha B'Av, July 23, 1942. They came to the outskirts of Stalingrad, and Hitler's plan, the original plan that's called Führer Directive number 41, the original plan was for the Nazis to surround Stalingrad, capture it if they could, but the important thing was to surround it, not to capture it, and then for the rest of the army to go down south over here and capture the oil fields. Because in order for your army to run and succeed, you need oil. And in this part of Russia, which you can't see so well, but in this part of Russia, there were oil fields that were necessary for the German military machine to continue. And that was the whole directive, and they were on the verge of doing that. Then a funny thing happened. It happened on July 23, 1942, called Hitler Directive number 45. The Führer Directive number 45 was dated July 23, 1942. Hitler personally intervened in the plans for this operation and ordered a split in Army Group South. That was his major army. The division of Army Group South had caused alarm in the general staff. The generals didn't agree with him. In fact, he fired one of them because of this. And Hitler was warned repeatedly about the dangers of this division entailed. What he did, in other words, he split his army, was going towards Stalingrad. And he said, you know what? I want to split it in half. And I'll just go back to the picture if we can see it for a second. He said, rather than sort of like hanging around here and sort of blocking off Stalingrad and getting the field over here, I want to have to go here, and I want half to go all the way down here, much deeper than I had anticipated. That's what he did on July 23, 1942. And just to go back to my photo here, you'll see at the end, latest studies confirm this split to be one of the main causes for the eventual demise of the German Sixth Army in Stalingrad. That historians have said that because Hitler made this decision, his armies were weaker. And now, on July 23, 1942, even though they were still strong, it was the beginning of the end. if Stalingrad was the turning point in the war, then it seems like, based on this, Hitler Directive 45 on July 23, 1942, was the seed, the beginning of the end of the Nazis' ability to capture Stalingrad and to win the war. See, we don't really know what that means. I mean, what does that mean? But what I just presented you and what's in the hidden hand is that on one hand, you have this heart, Tisha B'Av, is that date. You have the final solution, the Jews being sent off to Treblinka. On the other hand, you have this amazing coincidence that now it seems like the turning point of the war has taken place. Anyone want to suggest what that might mean or how to express that? What she said was that was the point I wanted. It's actually brought in the Jerusalem Talmud or in the Midrash. On the day the temple was destroyed, the Messiah was born. Exactly what that means, it means the idea is that in the deepest tragedy, and on the most tragic day in the Jewish calendar is Tisha B'Av. The sages of the Talmud and the Jewish greatest minds said that in the deepest tragedy, if you dig down deep enough, and it's not always possible to dig down deep enough, but in the darkest tragedy, deep in the tragedy, there's the seeds of redemption. There's the seeds of the Yeshua, of the salvation, of something good and positive coming around. Now, it's 2010, it's 68 years later. I think to myself, Moses was 80 when he came to become the leader of the people. So I don't know when the Messiah is, if he's going to be here when he's 80 or 40 or 90 or whatever it is. But it could be that he's going to be here. Now, on one hand, I thought to myself, well, if the Messiah comes around, the first thing you're going to do is check if his birthday was July 23, 1942. Whether it is or is not literal like that, and I'm not claiming that could be something like that, but the idea is that this date, Tisha B'Av, not only is the date of tremendous tragedy, but it's the date that has something in it, a glimmer of hope, as Rabbi Weinstein said earlier, a ray of light in the darkness. And that ray of light is the light that will ultimately disband the darkness entirely and completely. We may not see that. And in personal tragedies in life, we may not see that. But a person has to understand that a personal tragedy is always in it because there are no coincidences in life. Any personal tragedy, if we dig down deep enough, if we have the faith and the stamina to live it out long enough, we can often, hopefully, see that it is something that was great. A person gets fired from his job, God forbid, and looks like there's nothing going to be able to help him. And then finds another position, or he starts his own business because of that, and that becomes the thing that really saves him in his life, and it becomes his cause in life. Different tragedies that can happen. How do you deal with the tragedy of the death? I'm not saying I can answer that question, or we should answer that question. My mother-in-law certainly couldn't tell you that it was great that her siblings and a parent, mother and a father, and all these terrible things happened. But the idea of Tisha B'Av is that buried in the tragedy is a ray of hope and redemption and light for the ultimate good and the salvation. That is a Jewish concept. That is the classic and maybe the primary definition of what it means, the hidden hand of God. That we have to realize that whether it's national tragedy or personal tragedy, there's always something. And the tragedy, to a certain degree, if we use it, can be an opportunity to become a great and excellent thing. In fact, today, even though Tisha B'Av is a fast day, it's also called, in the rabbinic sources, it's called a moed, a holiday. One of the things that we normally do on days where things are bad, we say the Tachanun prayer. Tachanun is a prayer where we beseech God for salvation, and we're supplicating God for something that we lack. But on Tisha B'Av, we don't do Tachanun, because the rabbis say Tachanun is a moed, it's a festival, it's a holiday. What does that mean by that? It's not really a festival, but it's a moed, it's a special type of holiday. Why? Because not now, maybe not, we still got a few hours left, but at some point in the future, our Tisha B'Av will someday be a holiday. We'll realize that while the destruction has happened, the Messiah was born. where we lost $100,000, we got $1 million. Where we lost $10 million, we got $100 million. I'm not saying why we understand it. That goes back to the first verse, the angels in Ezekiel. Blessed is God from his place. I can't always say it. And I can only suggest these things anyway, and I don't know if we can. But if we don't know it, that is the message of Tisha B'Av, that is a day that buried in the tragedy is a ecstasy, is a wonderful redemption. We can't see it. We might not even see it. But the Jewish response is to have faith that it's there. We may not see it. We may not be able to, with our finite minds, to explain it. But it's there. That's the idea of Tisha B'Av. I don't have time to do the next part. The next part is an amazing thing, also related to Tisha B'Av. It's in this is my magazine that I'm editor of. There's an article in here called The Epic Battle of El Alamein. And it's just a remarkable thing of also what happened at that time, the Rommel was about to capture Palestine with its several hundred thousand Jews that seemed to secure from the Nazis. And at the last minute, it looked like he was going to break through. In fact, the Nazis had even sent a death squad to rouse the local Arabs. The Arabs were very anti-Semitic. In 2006, there were two German historians. These two people made a shocking discovery while examining documents from the Nazi period in German government archives. Documents revealing the detailed plans for the destruction of Palestine Jews. In other words, the Nazis in 1942, at the same time Stalingrad was happening, at the same time Treblinka was happening, Tisha B'Av, the Nazis were sending people to Palestine to have another final solution in Palestine. We know he's going to get a lot of help from the Mufti, the Grand Mufti, the head of the Arabs, who was one of the leading Nazis. He was such a leading Nazi that Hitler himself granted the Mufti a personal audience and promised that Germany supports a war with no compromises against the Jewish people, including a war against the Jewish national homeland in Palestine. He also clarified that Germany's goal in Palestine was to destroy the Jews who live in the Arab region under the protection of British might. These two together, along with the death squad, were supposed to wipe out the Jews. And Rommel, the leading Nazi general, was maybe a day or two away from doing it. And there were. This is the story that's in the magazine. This rabbi was one of the great tzaddikim, and he was not the only one, but he prayed. There's several stories up in the magazine article. He prayed around that time. He saw, and when it looked like things were going terrible, he prayed, I see the four-letter name of God in the fire above the four Chaim's grave. A great rabbi who lived 200 years beforehand wrote a commentary. Right? And then, just to show one last thing, the same rabbi said, Rabbi Yisrael, at that time, he had seen a message from heaven in the passage from the commentary of Or HaChaim on that week's portion in Numbers 24:17. Or HaChaim lived in the 1700s. In his commentary to Numbers 24:17, the Or HaChaim writes that the Jews of that time will have to fight a great warrior named Rommel, 200 years beforehand, and that if the Jews were worthy, they would be defeated. When Rabbi Yisrael saw that passage in the Or HaChaim, he said, we're going to be saved. Now, I want to tell you a caveat, and it's in here in the magazine. What happened was is that Rabbi Yisrael had an Or HaChaim whose print was a little bit off. The original print that the Midrash that the Or HaChaim was quoting says that in the future the Messiah will fight someone named Romulus. But in Rabbi Yisrael's Or HaChaim, the U.S. at the end was knocked off. And he actually saw in his copy of the Or HaChaim that they're going to be saved by Rommel. They're going to be saved from Rommel. And in fact, if I don't have time to do it, but here's a book written by, in 1942, Pipeline. The Pipeline to Battle, An Engineer's Adventures with the British Eighth Army. He was actually wrote this in 1943. He was there in 1942. He was in charge of the water supply to the British front that was supposed to, the last stand against Rommel's charging forces was at El Alamein. He made a water pipe, and in the end, the Nazis came so fast that they captured the water pipe. You can't fight. Even more important than guns and gas in the desert is water. Soldiers need water, else they can't fight. So the water pipe was crucial. When the Nazis got the water pipe, It looked like it was all over.
What? What happened?
Oops. Oh, here. Here, first he writes, the El Alamein line had been broached. Rainier wrote. His name is Peter Rainier. Peter Rainier. Rainier wrote, most people believe that the Alamein line held. I have just told the truth of it. The enemy was eventually halted, but not till he had penetrated many miles behind our prepared line of defense. And then he writes this. Then, as the battle broke off, an astonishing thing happened. More than 1,100 Germans walked across to our line with their hands, not their hands, in the air. Thirst had done it. Their tongues were literally hanging out of their mouths. For 36 hours, they had no fresh water to drink. That pipeline full of salt water. It turns out the pipeline that he had made, that Peter Rainier had made, because it was so new, when you make a new pipe, it's naturally going to have leaks and things that, you know, they have to test it. So to test it, they didn't want to test it with fresh water, which is so precious in the desert. They tested it with salt water. The Nazis came so fast that they hadn't had time yet to get rid of the salt water. The British didn't plan it this way. The Nazis went in there, and they cut into the pipe, dying of thirst, thinking that they were going to get more water. And what happened was, the pipeline full of salt water was the cause. They found and briefly tapped it. The seawater in it had increased their thirst almost to the point of delirium. This happened in the three-week period. It didn't happen on Tisha B'Av. This happened 3 weeks before Tisha B'Av, on the 17th of Tammuz. It's another day of fasting related to Tisha B'Av. I don't have time to go into details. It is detailed in this version, in this of the Zman magazine. I don't think I have any more. If you want any more, you can contact Mrs. Sarah or someone. We'll try and get you a copy or something like that, and to go from there. Bottom line is, we Jews believe in a hidden hand. We don't always see the hand. We don't know. Sometimes we do, sometimes we think we do, but if we don't, we have to believe it's there. It's a very Jewish response to tragedy, national, personal, or otherwise. Question?
What's the rationale for the Red 45? Why did he put the army?
Oh, there's a couple of reasons that they give. Firstly, the rationale is that the divine hand reached down and told Hitler to do this thing. What caused Hitler? There were two things. One is that he all of a sudden got very haughty, and he thought to himself, I don't want to just surround Stalingrad, meaning the oil is my objective. I want to destroy Stalingrad because it's the name of the Russian leader. It became symbolic to him. The other thing that he wanted to go south and get more oil fields, more than just the one that would have been enough for him, because he got very greedy. This was his he got out of control, and so he decided two things at one. He destroys Stalingrad and he can get much more oil fields. And therefore really clobber it. If he had been a little more, he had been more conservative and not intervened, had kept with this original plan, he would have blocked off this oil field from the Russians. It might have taken another year to do it, but there was no way. He lost it because of that. That's the way they explain it. Question? Well, you'll have to read the hidden hand by Yaakov Asher to see his approach to that question. Essentially, and Rabbi Friedman can attest to this, we are working on this curriculum for Jewish schools. There are 800 schools in the Torah Masorah network, and we have to come up with some sort of curriculum to teach them. And behind the scenes, you should know there are great rabbis waging this very great debate. And the debate, in my opinion, mirrors what's going on, what I showed you at the very, very beginning of the angels. Some say we can find reasons, we can identify reasons, and we should identify reasons, and we should teach these reasons, even if they're very harsh reasons or hard reasons to understand, right? And others say, no, we can't teach it because we can't know it. Blessed is the glory of God from his place. We can't know why. It's a very deep question. I can't do it justice in a short amount of time. I believe the answer is that we are finite beings, God is infinite, and by the nature of creation, there are certain things that we can't understand, certainly in this finite context, which is our physical lives. And that while we can try and understand as much as we can try to understand, we perforce are going to reach a point where we can't understand. And that's the face of God. That's the edge of our finiteness. God is beyond that. So I believe that there has to be things that we're going to be left with why. And it can't not be that way because we're not God. Even Moses, the Talmud says, there were things that he could not answer. Why did good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people? The Talmud says that. Moses, the greatest prophet, couldn't understand that. The Talmud, the rabbis, are telling us that there's a limitation to human understanding, and God not only wants it that way, that's the way it naturally has to be, because God is infinite, we're ultimately finite. Even a Moses is ultimately finite. And therefore the test as a Jew and as a person, as an intellectual or rational person, is that I try and understand that the world is filled with God's glories as much as I can, but if I reach a point where there's tragedy and I don't know why, I still bless God, the glory of God. I don't understand it, I don't know why, but I still bless it. And I can tell you, I can see that that's how my mother-in-law has survived and lived and lived such a productive life. Because she saw the tragedy as much as anybody, and that didn't stop her from going on with her life and being an inspiration to others. So the answer is, it's not really an answer, but you reach a point where you exhaust the limits of your natural abilities, reasoning abilities. There you have to say, I throw my hands into God. I believe there's a God. I don't necessarily know why I'm not God, but I believe there's a reason. That's how I look at it. And that's sort of, I try to explain a little bit in the book.
Your mother-in-law write the story?
No, she's told me her story, and I've recorded it, at least a lot of it, and I have it written up, but it's very, very raw, and my time is very limited, and hopefully one of these days I'll get around to it.
Another question I have is, when you are studying the history,
happens to be there's some evidence for that. Josephus writes that in the Second Temple, that was part of the plan, that they intended to do that. But they intended firstly two things. They intended to do that not because they wanted to, they really believed there was something in the day, something fatalistic in the day that would warrant it coming about, that would be a day they'd be successful. Right? Also, the idea is that the Romans did not plan this 5-year campaign and lose the 22nd Legion and many and hundreds of thousands of other soldiers just so they could destroy the temple on Tisha B'Av. It was close to Tisha B'Av, and he may have pushed it up a day or delayed it a day or did something like that. But it was not so much as you think that they all of a sudden picked. They had 365 days a year. Let's pick that day. But the other thing is that some of the events that I list on there clearly have nothing to do with planning. World War I. It's clearly nothing to do with anyone planning to start World War I on Tisha B'Av. I don't believe that the Nazis knew that they would send people to Treblinka on Tisha B'Av. You could say that. I'm not saying I know that definitively. It's not, but I think it's hard. It's not the most logical explanation. I don't think they knew that. Certainly, Hitler didn't pick this Hitler Directive 45 on knowing because it was Tisha B'Av. As you study these things more and more, and these are just a few of them. There's more than I've told over here. I think you'll conclude that certainly in the ancient world, it may be that they may have thought this day was a certain portent, something bad happened to the Jews, so they picked it. There may or may not be that, but in modern history, in the post Talmudic era, that's not really the case.
We have time for one more question.
Sure.
Children and future generations, make sure
coming up, and it's right here in our own country, and yet they seem to be detached from it. Some of the young people in this area that I speak to, and I don't want to go crazy when I tell them. You know, I don't want to frighten them. I don't want to say, yes, it could happen tomorrow. I want them to be alert that they have to, you know, get rid of that hate and prejudice and hatred. I sometimes get frustrated. I don't know what else, how else I can give me some clues to how else I can reach them.
I would answer like this. You're probably making more of an impact than you think, and you may not see the impact for many years. I'll speak for myself. I only got into the Holocaust 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. I remember my parents my parents were always very liberal, very nice about things, and let me do my own thing. But there was one time there's an exception to the rule. They wanted me to sit and watch this Holocaust documentary. They wanted me to study a Holocaust documentary. They wanted me to read this book on the Holocaust. And truth is, I was more into the Yankees. Gotta tell you, I was more into the vacation. You know, I wanted to go travel. I wanted to do whatever I wanted to do. I didn't really want to do it. And while my parents and I had a great relationship, my father passed away a few years ago. The fact is that I resented them for trying to impose that upon me. I don't want to. And now looking back upon it many years, I don't think I was ready for it. And I have a problem now with my own children, especially. They're not, you know, she's not into it. She can't understand it. And I think that in those type of situations, it sounds like a lot of the children are this generation. You can't shove it down their throats. But if you tell it in a way that's meaningful and that's true from within yourself, it'll sink in. It may not sink in now. It may not sink in when they're 18, when they're in their teens. It may not sink in their 20s or 30s. But you do it. You're doing the job. It's getting in. It's just a matter of time. And in the right place, it'll hit. It'll catch. It'll seed. It'll blossom.
Thank you.